hppodcraft.com.
I had been out of work for several months, and my savings were perilously near the vanishing point. Therefore, I was naturally elated when I received from John Carnby a favorable answer, inviting me to present my qualifications in person. Carnby had advertised for a secretary, stipulating that all applicants must offer a preliminary statement of their capacities by letter, and I had written in response to the advertisement.
You know, this might be one of the best secretarial positions since Maggie Gyllenhaal went to work for James Spader.
Definitely. Yeah. I have no sadomasochism, but very similar.
Well,
man, I would kill to have a secretary.
Yeah.
Somebody to take care of all these little things I can never seem to chase around.
So nice.
I've had interns, you know.
Yeah.
That's different. That's more like you're asking a surly teenager for a favor. You know? Hey, think you could read these two sections of the Necronomicon for me? Maybe by end of day? Oh, man, I'm more of a social media expert. The way you ask me is kind of threatening, like it's sexist, I think, maybe. I'll ask you this. What did we just hear at the top there?
That was the opening paragraph of Clark Ashton Smith's The Return of the Sorcerer.
Hmm.
Smith was a favorite author of H.P. Lovecraft, and that's why we're talking about him here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are at hppodcraft.com, and my name is Chad Pfeiffer.
And my name is Christopher John Lackey.
Our reader this week is the one and only Jeff C. Carter. Visit him online at Jeff C. Carter on Facebook, or check out his blog at jeffccarter.wordpress.com. We'll link out to it. He's also got one of those Patreon sites where you can kick in money and he'll produce short stories, that kind of thing for
you. Right, yes.
Speaking of fundraising, we hit our Kickstarter goal.
Ba-da-ba-da-o, yeah!
We are going to be doing these live shows in Providence and Chicago.
Yeah, thanks to all your help and support, we announced one stretch goal, which is Andrew Lehman's reading of The Statement of Randolph Carter.
Yes!
This is one of Andrew's personal favorite stories, and I'm sure he will bring something to this that will make it jump to life like it has never jumped to life before. He does that with all of his readings.
I don't want to be, you know, egomaniacal, but I think that the Call of Cthulhu, Haunter of the Dark readings we have on the site are the definitive readings of those stories.
Absolutely.
As far as I'm concerned.
And this will soon be, if we make the stretch goal, the definitive reading of The Statement of Randolph Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to also announce our second stretch goal. If we are to be so lucky to make our first stretch goal,
yes,
then hopefully we can do the second one. But that will be a reading of Charlotte Perkins Gilman's The Yellow Wallpaper, as read by Heather Klinke.
When we reach $7,200, that's what we're going to produce for you as well.
Yep.
Lots of folks have been asking for it. Dug her reading on the show and would like to have the full version, so kick in if you want to hear it. Now that we know the live shows are on, we'll be locking down venue and guest details and getting those out to everybody shortly. You can still pre-buy tickets to those shows through the Kickstarter. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Most of our shows have sold out. Most of our shows. We've done two. But the first one sold out, and the second one almost sold out? Sell out?
We were full.
It was a full house.
Yeah.
We definitely had a full house. So make sure you get your tickets soon and often.
Exactly.
Now to the story. We begin with this unemployed guy, Mr. Ogden, who's looking for work. He gets a job interview with this guy, John Carnby, who's looking for a secretary. Though the work he describes seems to be maybe more of an assistant, really, than a secretary?
You have to have a lot of education for this job.
Exactly. He's particularly interested in Ogden's knowledge of Arabic,
yes,
the language.
He needs somebody that can translate Arabic.
This job interview is at Carnby's house in Oakland, California, I'm assuming.
Sure.
It's, of course, an old creepy house, lots of ivy surrounded by ancient oaks and a burned out mansion.
I must just be kind of a little sick with envy today because I'm like, first he gets a secretary, then he's got a creepy old house in Northern California. Carnby's got everything. This house has furtive, shadowy windows built in.
Yeah, we just have double glazed windows here. No furtive shadows.
Oh, if it gets too hot, I can't close my windows. I need the furtive, shadowy ones.
So the story jumps immediately once he gets to the house, just jumps to him being in front of Carnby. The guy gives him a creeps a bit. He's a loner, scholarly type. He describes him as being thin and bent with a massive forehead and a mane of grizzled hair. And the pallor of the library was on his hollow, clean-shaven cheeks.
His voice is unexpectedly deep and sonorous, which, you know who would be a good Carnby? Christopher Lee.
Oh, yeah.
He would have been good, but rest in peace, buddy. He just passed away last week.
Yeah, one of the greats.
He was in one Lovecraft adaptation, The Curse of the Crimson Altar with Karloff and Barbara Steele, which is an adaptation of Dreams in the Witch House. I think it's a pretty loose adaptation of that.
All right.
This story, however, was adapted for Night Gallery, and Carnby was played by good old Vincent Price.
Oh, wow.
And the other character was played by Bill Bixby.
Oh, man, that would be really cool.
You know, I love Vincent Price, and Bill Bixby is always solid as well.
So Carnby asks some questions about Arabic, the language, and how well he knows it. And he answers them and he goes, okay, you're hired. You got the job, buddy. He tells Ogden that he keeps odd hours and he works way into the night. So it's could be rough, rough work. But he will stay in the house with him while he works. He's got a room for him. And Carnby will feed him as well.
Yeah. And he's not going to be ordering Domino's either. Carnby is going to cook for him.
Yeah.
He says, I guarantee my cooking will not poison you. So it's kind of a privileged assistant when your boss does the cooking for you.
Yeah. It's kind of a strange detail to have in the story. It doesn't really go anywhere, but it's brought up again a few times in the story.
Well, it's that Dracula kind of thing. You know, he has no help from anybody. He's just all alone in the house. I guess it's trying to reinforce that.
So he wants him to start right away. Tells him to go back to his apartment, pack up his stuff, and come back immediately that day.
Mm-hmm.
And Ogden's like, well, I really need the work, so okay, yeah, I'm up for it. Let's do it.
I had a really similar interview like this with Andy Dick.
Oh, back in my 20s. I forgot you had an Andy Dick interview.
Yeah, well, not just an interview. I worked for him for a little bit, but he put out an ad for, I think it was for assistance of some kind, and I was pretty young and I needed a job. I sent him my resume, and then he called and he's like, I see you've done a lot of writing. This was right after News Radio when he was sober and trying to put up a production company together. I went over to interview him and he was really nice dude. You know, he liked me and was like, you know, you don't need to be assistant. Maybe you can write for me and we can work together in that regard. But it was that weird thing because he's a wealthy dude. He had like a Calvin Klein model girl just kind of around. Couldn't really figure out what her role was. And like, but he was very aggressive about me moving in with him, which was my first clue that this might not be a good work relationship.
Wow.
Do you remember that? He was like,
I don't remember the fact that he wanted you to move in.
Yeah.
With him,
he's like,
but I remember you like going to interviews and him being kind of weird.
Well, he was just like, you know, I really like what you're doing. I think we can work together. It would really work a lot better if you lived here in the house. And it was like, that's just, doesn't seem professional to me, you know? What's really the agenda here, you know? It was weird. I went back and forth with him on a few projects, and then it just kind of fizzled out.
Dude, you know, it would have been awesome if you did move in with him. Like, think of the stories you would have.
Well, hey.
The crazy things you would have seen.
Oh, dude. Well, my wife saw him a couple of years ago at a comedy place, and she said, oh, you know, you might know my husband. He worked with you, you know, maybe 10 years ago or something like that, and Andy was all messed up, and he's like licked her hand and said, and he goes, did he molest my children? And then he licked her arm or something like that. And it was just really gross. That guy's nuts. He keeps getting in trouble for peeing on people. You're right. I should have moved in with him. What was I thinking?
That was a mistake. Cause I'm sure it would have been horrible. He would have had some traumatic experience.
Yeah.
But
it would be in the past now.
You could have wrote a book.
That's true.
Just based on those experiences alone.
Well, let's pretend that this story that we're going to finish here is really the account of what happened to me. So our narrator does move in with him.
He does. Yeah, Ogden gets a room on the second floor, which is a bit dusty, but way nicer than his old apartment. Really big, got some cool furniture, just amazing.
Mm.
And the study where he's going to be doing his work is awesome. When he walks in, he looks at it and he goes, the sentence is great. It was very much as I should have imagined in the den of some old sorcerer to be.
Yeah.
Kind of hits the nail on the head with it right away.
Right, right. But that's what it looks like. It's got all these cases of books that are overflowing. And of course, it's all modern and ancient works on demonology and the black arts.
Dude, I love the black arts. Well, just the idea, like black magic.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be true. It's that idea.
What do you mean? It can't be true.
It's one of those things where almost like in science fiction, you know how like a good science fiction idea is well thought out.
Right.
Whereas like the idea of having black magic is not necessarily a really well thought out idea.
Mm-hmm.
It seems in these stories that the deterrent of black magic is that eventually it's going to bite you in the ass and
Then
you're going to have to pay some horrible price for it.
Yeah. You got to be really desperate or nuts to pursue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But in the real world, there are so many people that are desperate and or crazy that tons of people would be doing black magic, like all the time.
But I think it would be more like everybody would use it, but just a little, which is probably a little more common.
Right.
You know what I mean? Would they trend towards a norm? Because in these stories, it's always they've given themselves over to black magic. But I think people would, you know, like I cursed Steve today, but, you know, I haven't cursed anybody in like 2 months. So it's okay. Because freaking Mary over there, every 2 days, she's cursing somebody.
Yeah.
I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
Just the way that people, they lie a little, they steal a little. Everybody does a little bit.
But there's something also about this idea, too, that I feel like it's sort of this idealized world
mm-hmm.
that people are sane enough and not evil that they don't touch black magic, that it remains mostly unused in these worlds, these right. fictional worlds that it exists in.
Yeah.
And there's something kind of nice about that. If that makes sense. You know, like the kind of the world where black magic exists is actually kind of a nicer world than our actual world.
Sure. Well, because that means there's some kind of I mean, if it's black magic, that means there's like some good magic, which means the good and evil exist.
Yeah.
And that people by their nature are good and they don't want to dabble in that. And that people that do awful things get punished for it.
Yeah. And I really like that.
I mean, it could just be maybe the comment is has nothing to do with people's good or evil natures, but more that like, it's difficult to do black magic and most people are just lazy. I mean, how many people are going to read that book?
That's true. It's a lot of work reading that book. What's interesting about this room as well is that there's a typewriter in mm-hmm. there, which kind of gives it that more modern sensibility.
Yeah.
In an alcove in this library, mm-hmm. between a human skeleton and an ape skeleton yeah. is this locked cupboard, which is very important at a point here. But Carnby goes on to say that his study of demonism and sorcery is his life's work. He doesn't believe in any of it. He's just really fascinated by it. And he's trying to find connections of demon worship throughout time and places in man's history. And he has a copy of the original Arabic Necronomicon that he thinks when the Latin version was translated, there was bits left out of it. And mm-hmm. that's why he's brought here. But my question is, were these passages left out of the Greek translation of the Necronomicon?
I don't know.
Why is that not brought up in the story?
My answer to that is probably because the story is kind of stupid. I was sorry to go right in with my opinion, but in this regard especially, there's this original Arabic Necronomicon, and when the Latin version was made, presumably the things that were left out for some. They were more horrific. But then when we get the passages, which we're about to, they're mm-hmm. not really that horrific.
No.
It's just some instructions for a couple of things. And so if those were the things that were redacted, then everything else must be really lame in the Necronomicon. Right? If these were the things that Olaus Wormius wouldn't translate because they were too scary, that means everything else is less scary than these two pretty mundane things, which makes me feel like the Necronomicon is really just this notebook where a teenager writes his ideas for lyrics, you know? It's just drawings of demons and dumb things.
Well, this isn't what I took out of it. I thought the reason those things were redacted was because Olaus didn't want people to know that sorcerers could, what we're going to find out eventually, mm-hmm. can come back from the dead, because maybe he was planning on coming back from the dead and he didn't want people to know about it.
Okay. That's a good point.
It was a matter of it being scary. It was a matter of it like, well, I want to keep that information to myself.
Hmm. Okay.
But you're right. The story is not really scary.
Well, this there's other ways the story is dumb.
Yeah.
So I stand by that. But you do have a point there.
Of course, Ogden has heard of the Necronomicon because mm-hmm. everybody has yeah. this crazy, ancient, really secret book that everybody knows about. And he even knows about the mad Arab, Abdul al-Hazred. He also wonders how Carnby got a hold of this very, very rare book. The original Arabic is super, super rare. Afterwards, Carnby cooks dinner and he eats with Ogden. And then they talk for a bit. Ogden says, that Carnby seems less nervous when they first met, and he's a little bit more relaxed. Carnby pulls out, eventually after the meal, and they talk about the Necronomicon. He pulls it out, shows Ogden, and he shows him the section that he wants translated. And this is what Ogden gets.
It is verily known by few, but is nevertheless no attestable fact, that the will of a dead sorcerer hath power upon his own body, and can raise it up from the tomb and perform therewith whatever action was unfulfilled in life. And such resurrections are invariably for the doing of malevolent deeds and for the detriment of others. Most readily can the corpse be animated if all its members have remained intact. And yet there are cases in which the excelling will of the wizard hath reared up from death the sundered pieces of a body hewn in many fragments, and hath caused them to serve his end, either separately or in a temporary reunion. But in every instance, after the action hath been completed, the body lapseth into its former state.
Wizards can come back from the dead,
mm-hmm.
like a lich. We talked about before. The creepier bit of this is that if you chop them up, if you're powerful enough of a wizard, you can still pull yourself back together.
Right.
Or you can just have your parts move around on their own.
Yeah.
Which is pretty gross. And it freaks Carnby out. When he reads this passage, he's scared by mm-hmm. it. And then they hear something in the hallway, some kind of dragging sound. Carnby says, oh, we have rats in the house. We've tried to get rid of them. We can't get rid of them. I don't know what's going on. And this pacifies Ogden for the time being. Carnby asks him to reread it just to make sure that he understood what was being read.
I can understand why Ogden would not maybe make the connection, because he probably doesn't believe in supernatural stuff. But like, yeah. Rats in the hallway right at this moment as he reads that. Is there like a reader in the world who believes that that's what's going on? It's so obvious that there's little body parts running around down the hallway.
It is.
And it bothers Carnby when he hears the passage. You know, he asked him to read it again because he was distracted by those noises. But he reads it again and it corresponds to what's going out there in the hall.
And he's just white as a sheet. But he calmly says, she's trying to act cool, keep it together. He goes, oh, you know, that's funny because that's not in the Latin Necronomicon.
And then there's some more slithering sounds in the hallway. Carnby asks Ogden to translate another passage. This one is a little different.
It's an incantation that exorcises the dead.
Also not in the Latin Necronomicon.
And this lightens Carnby up a bit.
It's a ritual that involved the use of rare Arabian spices and the proper intoning of at least 100 names of ghouls and demons, which shook me out of things, too. I was like, 100?
That's a lot of names.
That's a lot of names. That's like being at the most boring graduation ceremony, you know? Beelzebub, Behemoth, Belial, Blaine.
Wait, hold on.
Barry.
Wait a minute, hold
Benjamin.
On.
Benjamin.
This is the most boring graduation? Because this sounds like the most awesome graduation ever. It's got demons in it.
That's true.
So anyway, they talk into the night about Necronomicon and the other things. Mm. As the talk goes on, Ogden figures out that Carnby is afraid of something and that his interest in the occult is not purely academic.
No, there's something going on with him. He dreads being alone, and he's always kind of listening with this painful, tortured expectation. Which, come on, he's listening because there's body parts running around.
As the night wears on, Carnby sees that it's late and he apologizes for keeping Ogden up too late and tells him, you know, go to bed, it's all right. On his way to his room, down the dark hallway, he hears a noise and then he sees something. It's a small, indistinct body that sprang from the hall, landing to the top stair, disappearing from view. And it startled him because it was really pale.
Yeah.
You know, like it didn't seem like it was a rat. And the shape of it didn't suggest the rat either, but it just moved so quickly that he couldn't really see it. And he heard this sound on the stairs, a singular bumping sound like the fall of an object rolling downwards from step to step.
I got that part was pretty neat. As I knowing what it was is still, I could see the scene and how strange and creepy that would be.
But this freaks him out pretty good. So he just gets in his room, locks himself in. And he's so tired because it's so late. He eventually just kind of goes to sleep because he's still under the rat assumption here. He suspects maybe something's up, but it's still Ratsville for him. In the morning, he dresses, goes downstairs, and he finds breakfast is waiting for him on the table.
Carnby says, I hope the rats didn't annoy you too much. Something really must be done about them. Which I would say, like, okay, do something about them today. You just moved me in here. It's full of rats.
Hey, I'm your assistant. Let me call an exterminator and deal with it for you.
Well, all day, Carnby locks himself up in the sorcery room and leaves Ogden down to his own devices in the library. And he doesn't know what Carnby's doing up there because he's dumb. Obviously, he's doing that incantation that he translated. It says, more than once I heard the faint, monotonous intonations of a solemn voice. And you know, it's that Abaddon, Amon, Amy, the other Amy. Tall Amy. And then also he finally, when Carnby says, hey, you can come upstairs, when he goes into the room, there are all the smells of these Arabic spices, which was mentioned earlier. He's like, whoa, what's going on? Could this be related to those passages that I translated? He says, I thought of the awesome formula I had translated at his request.
It seems pretty obvious. And it kind of is annoying when the character in the story is really, really blind to what's going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, in typical suspense, it can be very effective for the reader to know something that the characters in the story don't.
Yeah.
It creates tension because you're just waiting for the revelation to come to them. But
sure.
Here, it doesn't create tension. And I get the sense that maybe Smith knows it by this point because he's about to, you know, open up the kimono, so to speak.
Right.
That night after dinner, Carnby's got Ogden typing up a bunch of his occult notes on that typewriter you mentioned when they hear the slithering in the hall again. And then there are more sounds. There's more sounds of an unidentifiable slithering and scuttling nature that varied in loudness. It's as if a whole army of rats were hauling some carrion booty along the floor. Carrion booty is one of my favorite dance tracks. And Carnby's saying, it's the rats! I tell you, it's the rats! Don't think about what's out there.
But he can't take it.
The nightmare doubt and tension became unbearable, and I ran to the door and flung it open in spite of a frantic remonstrance from my employer. I had no idea what I should find as I stepped across the sill into the dim-lit hall. When I looked down and saw the thing on which I had almost trodden, my feeling was one of sick amazement and actual nausea. It was a human hand which had been severed at the wrist. A bony, bluish hand like that of a week-old corpse, with garden mold on the fingers and under the nails. The damnable thing had moved! It had drawn back to avoid me, and it was crawling along the passage, somewhat in the manner of a crab. And following it with my gaze, I saw that there were other things moving beyond it, one of which I recognized as a man's foot, and another as a forearm. I dared not look at the rest. All were moving slowly, hideously away in a charnel procession, and I cannot describe the fashion in which they moved. Their individual vitality, horrifying beyond endurance. It was more than the vitality of life, yet the air was laden with a carrion taint.
Carrion taint, another great club track. Hey, good. Some good Reanimator action here.
It is Reanimator. That's exactly what I was thinking. And I don't know what year this story came out, but Reanimator was one of Lovecraft's earlier stories. So I wonder if there's...
Yeah, I don't know.
If there's any connection. And it's a revenge story where you're going to find out that body parts are coming after a guy.
Yeah.
So it seems like it's pretty much Reanimator, maybe with a little bit of Statement of Randolph Carter thrown in.
I was happy, at least, with this little set piece that we didn't have to pretend that we didn't know what was going on anymore.
Right, yeah.
Hands and feet moving around, pretty scary. I think a haunted... Yeah. Forearm is a little lame. I mean...
Yeah, how does it move?
I don't know. After the hand and foot, the head is obviously scary, but anything else...
Does it just roll around? I mean,
I don't know. You can't have a haunted ass running around. That wouldn't be scary.
Well...
A torso bouncing up and down. I think he makes some reference to its awful torso.
That could be pretty... That sounds ghastly to me.
But how does it move?
Well, torso could wiggle, twist around.
Hmm.
But like a forearm, there's no... There's nothing to move. It's just a bone with some flesh on it.
Well, Carnby sees this, starts shaking, and then he just straight up confesses.
He's stronger than I am, even in death, even with his body dismembered by a surgeon's knife and a saw that I used. I buried the portions in a dozen different places.
But the Necronomicon was right.
And Hellman Carnby knew it. Hellman is his brother.
Yeah.
Not just his brother, his twin brother.
Right. He had attained higher power and knowledge and was more favored by the Dark Ones than Carnby. And that's why I killed my own twin brother and my brother in the service of Satan and those who were before Satan. Sorry, I just had to play a little death metal riff there.
That was good, man.
Yeah, that was just too awesome. Those who came before Satan. I'm working for Satan's parents.
So he talks about how his brother went mad. You know, he was into the dark arts as well, but his brother really got into it, and he just got so powerful that he was afraid of him, and he decided, well, he's going to take him out via the axe and chop him up. But he didn't know about this whole sorcerer business, can come back from the dead kind of thing, until he read the Necronomicon, and that was what was going on there.
I mean, he assumed that's what was going on. It was 10 days since he killed his brother. It says, but Hellman or some part of him has returned every night. It could just form up Voltron style and come in and take him out.
Yeah.
But he says he wants me to go mad. He wants to torture me till my brain gives way. Now, he didn't bury the head.
The head is in that cabinet that we talked about earlier in the story. Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes he hears it moving around in there. And actually, earlier in the story, we heard it moving around in the cupboard as well.
Yeah.
The body doesn't need the head. All the parts can move independently.
That's not where his soul lies. It's not in his head. It's somewhere in the ether.
You know, I was happy about this because often in standard stories, you have the incantation, and then you have some sort of antidote to it. You know, you have some other thing you can do that'll stop the horror, which this was his, that formula, that the second translation, that was his hope. And he had done it that day, said the 100 demon names, didn't work.
Didn't do squat.
Nope. He thought maybe it would hold his brother off, but no, it doesn't work. And those body parts are out there. And Ogden says, you know what? I'm getting out of here now.
Yeah, this is crazy town. Carnby begs him to stay. He's like, please, I'm so lonely and I don't know what to do. And this is horrible. And he goes, yeah, forget it. I'm getting out of here. I'm going to pack my things and leave. Yeah. And I personally wouldn't even bother packing my things.
No, not me.
I would have just ran because there was disembodied feet and hands and arms and things crawling around. Once that happens, you know, I could rebuy a new valise,
right?
Some shoes, whatever. It doesn't matter. I don't have anything that's important.
No way.
To keep me even for a minute longer in a house where there is a butt that will attack me.
Well, Ogden, I don't know. He must have a collection of vests or something that he really likes. He runs down to his room, packs his things crazily. But then he hears footsteps going up to Carnby's study. He hears them go up. He hears them pause at the Carnby's room. There's an awful crashing and shattering noise, and above it, the scream of a man in the uttermost extremity of fear. Well, now he's got to find out what happened.
He says that something possesses him. Something draws him into the study. He feels like he's almost being mind controlled.
Yes, like there has to be a witness to this.
I don't know if he's actually being mind controlled or if it's just his curiosity so strong that he can't resist it.
Yeah, it could go either way, but I think that the implication is that maybe the timing is like this because the sorcerer wanted a witness. The sorcerer wanted somebody to see what he had done.
Yeah.
And here we have this character got the confession, so somebody knows that he was killed. And now he can reform into Mega Sorcerer and go up and give his brother a beatdown, which is what he did when Ogden gets up there. The door of the study had been broken in, was hanging by one hinge, and he sees the gruesome outlines of a monstrous, unmoving shadow. Huge, elongated, misshapen, is seemingly cast by the arms and torso of a naked man who stooped forward with a saw in his hand. So he's getting the eye for an eye kind of revenge.
Right.
Its monstrosity lay in this, though it had shoulders, the chest, and abdomen, it was headless and appeared to terminate in an abruptly severed neck. So that head is still in the cabinet.
Yeah, he says it's a shadow of a naked man. So does that mean that he could see the shadow of his ding-dong?
Of course. Glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, because I was thinking, naked. Why does he say he's naked? I'm like, oh, maybe because he's talking about his ding-dong.
Well, that's the point of the story. from the direction of the locked cupboard, there came a fearsome and violent crash. So the head breaks out.
Yeah.
And then, without warning, he sees the shadow kind of disintegrate.
Yeah, it turns into its component parts.
Falls to the ground. And he knows, if I go over there and look, it's going to be a heap of human segments. Some of them new and some of them old and putrefied. But
and he does.
A reddened knife and saw were protruding from the pile. And a little to one side, between the rug and the open cupboard with its shattered door, there reposed a human head that was fronting the other remnants in an upright posture. It was in the same condition of incipient decay as the body to which it had belonged, but I swear that I saw the fading of a malignant exultation from its features as I entered. Even with the marks of corruption upon them, the lineaments bore a manifest likeness of John Carnby, and plainly they could belong only to a twin brother. The frightful inferences that smothered my brain with their black and clammy cloud are not to be written here. The horror which I beheld, and the greater horror which I surmised, would have put to shame hell's foulest enormities in their frozen pits. There was but one mitigation and one mercy. I was compelled to gaze only for a few instants on that intolerable scene. Then, all at once, I felt that something had withdrawn from the room. The malign spell was broken. The overpowering volition that had held me captive was gone. It had released me now, even as it had released the dismembered corpse of Helman Carnby. I was free to go, and I fled from the ghastly chamber and ran headlong through an unlit house and into the outer darkness of the night.
That's the end of the story.
And bam!
That is freaking gross, man.
That's pretty gross. But completely no surprise that that's
what. No, not at all. But I mean, it's a pile of two humans chopped up in a big pile.
And twins, too. So that's got to add an extra layer of weirdness to it.
Yeah. It's really messed up, the story, to be honest. It's one of those where it's just, why? And the whole fact that they were twins, too, I guess, is that just so that the end image is even more creepy?
Yeah, I guess so.
Because there didn't seem to be any real significance. There wasn't anybody pretending to be another twin, which is usually the whole reason why they have twins in stories. You know, like,
I think it was just that they were equally matched in all things, but one got ahead, and so, you know, it was kind of a Cain and Abel story. Jealousy motivated the brother to kill the other brother.
But why couldn't they just be brothers? Why did it have to be twins? Identical twins at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's strange. I don't know. It's not a very good story. This is the kind of the first Clark Ashton Smith story that I've read that I've just kind of gone, eh.
Yeah. No, well, none of them so far have really blown me away. But I had fun with this. I mean, as I was reading it, it had a good pulpy... I've called it stupid and dumb throughout this podcast, but I did enjoy the read.
It's an easy read. He's a good writer in that respect. It's not a struggle. You just read it and enjoy it. And it's, you know, it's pulp. So there you go.
And it's amusing. I mean, I don't know. I'm amused by it. You see everything coming, but it's kind of a fun ride.
We've said that with Lovecraft also.
Absolutely.
A lot of Lovecraft stuff was totally telegraphed, and that's just his style, and that's the way he's doing it. And maybe this is, you know, paint a little, obviously he's using the Necronomicon, and he must be paying a little bit of an homage to Lovecraft himself.
Yeah, I think so. I just think that he's a little less controlled about when he reveals, you know, because Lovecraft's all about create some verisimilitude, create some reality,
mm-hmm.
and then have the weird thing enter later. Whereas Clark Ashton Smith seems to be right away, let's get it in there, let's go.
Yeah.
Monster time.
It's all right. Yeah. We got to change it up.
There's room for it all, you know?
It's a big, wonderful world of weird fiction out there.
Things don't have to be one way.
Sure don't.
What do you want to read next?
Next, there, I want to go to the future.
Oh, I like that.
To the year, I think it's, let's see, I think it's 2030.
Oh, dear.
In the story called Master of the Asteroid.
Yes. That sounds great.
This story was suggested by one of our listeners when we asked for ideas, and a few people suggested this one, and I wanted to do a sci-fi one because this is in the future. You know, this is about 100 years or so in the future of when it was written. I always love sci-fi from the early part of the last century because their ideas of what the future is going to be like are usually pretty entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely. And plus, you know, after coming out of the Robert E. Howard month and doing one of Clark Ashton Smith's more Dunsanian pieces, it's nice. I didn't want to go back and do a prehistory thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's get some sci-fi in here. We don't have enough of that.
And this is going to be our last Clark Ashton Smith story for the month.
Yes.
Because month will be ending. So Clark Ash June Smith it will be ending, and we'll be tackling another writer next.
Yeah, we'll be moving on to some other topic or writer. We're not sure what that's going to be yet, but that'll be our last one. So hold on to the suggestions. We're holding on to them because I'm sure we will come back to Mr. Smith. In the meantime, I want to thank our reader for this episode, Jeff C. Carter.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We will link out to Jeff's site if you want to look him up and see what he's up to.
And I also want to remind folks that our Kickstarter is still running, so please get over there and give us a few bones. Help us out.
Yes, and for those of you who have contributed and supported us, thank you so much. We are so grateful.
Yeah.
Especially you who subscribed to the show already. That's really outstanding.
Yeah, thank you so much. If you can afford it, please give us a little bit more and we could do these live readings that people have been asking for a while. So.
And that's all we have for this episode. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.